Okay, this is an interview with Konrad Dannenberg on November 7th, 1989 in Huntsville, Alabama, interview by Michael Neufeld. Okay, I want to start with we always start these interviews with a general biographical background information.
Mm-hmm.
So could you give your birth date, birthplace, occupation of your parents, and so forth,
mm-hmm.
that kind of information?
Well, I was born in Weißenfels, which is mm-hmm. just south of Leipzig, which is now pretty much in mm-hmm. the news these days.
Right.
So today, of course, it's Eastern Germany. In mm-hmm. those days, of course, there was just one Germany.
It was Saxony.
Yeah. My dad was in the army, and he moved pretty soon after my birth on the 5th of August, 1912. He moved mm-hmm. pretty soon to Hanover, and I really spent most of my youth years in Hanover. I went to school there. I visited the university in Hanover.
Mm-hmm.
And in the late 1920s, we had some rocket tests taking place in the vicinity of Hanover. You may have heard about
yeah.
Borchwedel,
mm-hmm.
where some Opel cars were being tested with solid propellant
motors
strapped to it. And we had a suitable racetrack, so they came to Hanover. And I participated in these tests. I understand they made three of them, and I seem to recall that I saw two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that interested me and some other people I worked with, some of my comrades in that at that time, to really become interested in rocketry.
Mm-hmm.
So I started relatively early. In fact, we were thinking about rocketry already before we saw these tests, and these tests just provided some additional initiative. And
I wanted to ask, is your father an army officer? At the
right.
Mm-hmm. And was he killed in the First World War?
No,
he
survived.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he stayed then in Hanover. He was during the war already in Hanover. My mm-hmm. mother was there. I had a sister. She died during the war. And he worked for the post office.
Mm-hmm.
He was on long-term duty in the army, and the German army then normally provided employment in the post office, or rails, or some mm-hmm. federally run organization. So he was working for the post office
mm-hmm.
when I grew up. And
he didn't continue on in the Reichswehr.
Right, he did not.
Mm-hmm.
And after I had seen these tests, of course, we became quite interested in rocketry, and we had our own little rocket field in Hanover.
Mm-hmm.
It was not quite as well known as the one in Berlin, where von Braun worked, but you probably know there were many of these amateur rocket societies.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, people after World War I at that time, they were really interested to look a little bit broader ahead,
mm-hmm.
and there was not too much going on in Germany. We had the big inflation even during those years. And so people, I think in general, became quite interested in Raumfahrt,
mm-hmm.
in
space
exploration.
Mm-hmm.
We had the movie Die Frau im Mond in the late 20s or early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Must have been around that time.
It was the end of 1929.
Yeah. And that all enthused us. So when I finally heard about Peenemünde, I learned about Peenemünde from a fellow I had been working with, Pullenberg, Albert Pullenberg,
mm-hmm.
who is also still living in Germany today.
Mm.
He lives in the Ulm area. And he was really the head, so to speak, of our rocket activities in Hanover. He was the most active one. He later on even married a girl who had a kind of a shop that he could really build on a bigger scale rockets, launch facilities and things like that. He did not decide to come to this country after the war. He decided to stay over there. And he took, even after the war, his own rocket activities up again.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned through him about Peenemünde. Of course, he couldn't tell me we build rockets here.
Mm-hmm.
That was top secret. So he indicated in his letter to me between the lines, he has some work going on, which I'm sure you would like, and why don't you try to get away from whatever you're doing now and come and join me here in, and I think the name at that time was Karlshagen or some place close by where most of the people lived. And when the war started, I had graduated in the meantime. I went in Hanover to school, as I mentioned earlier. And maybe one thing is even of interest. I went purposely into the area of diesel fuel combustion, diesel fuel injection, because we had learned in Hanover that that was, in, at that time, one of the big problems. Mm-hmm. How do you really properly introduce your propellants into your rocket chamber? How do you mix them properly, and what do you have to do in order to get good combustion?
Right.
So in order to learn more about it, I started diesel fuel injection. Of course, no one taught anything about rocketry, but that was the closest field to it. And when the war ended, I was a volunteer in the German army. So I initially was drafted in the German army. Mm-hmm. But they sent me to a horse-drawn anti-tank battalion. Mm-hmm. And that was for me enough reason that I finally got out of the army. I could use the fact that I, as a technical man with a Dippel Inc. in engineering, that I shouldn't serve in a horse-drawn company. Mm-hmm. And so I managed to get out of the army, and I worked at that time before, just before the war, for the VDO. They built tachometers. You, if you drive a Mercedes, you probably have a VDO tachometer in your Mercedes. Mm-hmm. Of course, during the war, they built all kind of wartime instruments, mostly radar-type, communication-type instruments. And they got me out of the army. They justified it with they needing me. And once I was back at the VDO, I didn't have too much of a problem to get from the VDO then transferred to Peenemünde.
Okay.
So that's the way I finally came to Peenemünde in the summer of 40, okay. Early summer of 40.
Can I? I want to ask you a number of detailed questions before we even get to that stage. When your experiments with, and you participated in these rail car experiments, and it would have been 1920.
Well, I watched them. I didn't participate.
Okay, you you were there. That was Opel, was it?
That was Opel.
That
wasn't
Valier, because I know that they had gone their separate ways just after the rocket car business.
Valier had also been in town. He had given an inspiring talk. He was a pretty good talker. You probably heard about him, yeah.
I've written an article.
And he was a little bit the von Braun type, yeah. He could go to the public, he could talk to them, he could convince them. And he did a lot of work, of course, yeah. Mm-hmm. But these tests, you are right, they were done by Opel.
When did you begin working with Alfred Pullenberg in that little rock?
Well, that
group
must have been in the late 20s. Mm-hmm. It was before we saw the railroad tests, and they were, I think, in 28, possibly 29. And we had started to work on our rockets before that, but that really gave us some additional new spirit again.
Really?
Of course, we didn't have any real funds. We had to spend our pocket money. And we started out with solids. So we bought solids. You could buy them in Germany in those days, fireworks rockets. We took them apart. We cut them open, built them in bigger rockets. And that was really the beginning of the work. And then we finally became aware of Owart's book. I had also read already relatively early Goddard's book, How to Reach Greater Altitudes by Means of Rockets. And we decided that, yes, the right way to go is really to use liquids. So we switched relatively early in the 27-28 time period to the use of liquids. And we were fortunate enough, I was living in Hanover. Hanover was a fairly large city, and we had an air liquefaction plant in Hanover. And separating air, you can easily make liquid oxygen. And through a professor at the university, an aeronautics professor, Proll, we got permission to use some of their liquid oxygen and to use liquid oxygen as an oxidizer.
This was, Proll was P-R-O, umlaut.
P-R-O, umlaut, double L.
Double L, okay.
Yeah, and he's dead now. He was already an old man at that time, so he's not alive anymore. But he wrote a number of books, and he was interested in rocketry, probably even from the viewpoint of application to airplanes. You probably know, right after World War I, Germany was not allowed to build powered airplanes. So people strapped solid propellants and later on liquid propellants onto sailplanes to get up into the air.
Mm-hmm.
That was one method. There were other methods to get up into the air.
Mm-hmm.
And actually in Hanover we had a contract from one of the sailplane people, Espenlaub, to build a rocket for him, a liquid propelled rocket for him, and to eventually deliver it. But we had so many problems we never came to the point of delivery.
Yeah, this, all of this sounds very familiar. You see, I've written an article about that period in the late 20s, and I know that the sailplane idea really took off after the rocket car,
mm-hmm.
and so forth in 1928, in April 28.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you're very sure that you and Alfred Pullenberg and anybody else in that group started before you ever even heard of the rocket cars and so forth.
Right, that came later. I'm pretty sure about that. We had been working on it mm-hmm. before that.
Because I don't know of any other private rocket experiments that were going at that time. So if that's true, you would mm-hmm. be maybe the first. You know, Rocket and Flugplatz didn't start till 1930.
Mm-hmm.
So that I don't know of any other starting so early.
Were there not other activities going on?
I don't know of any private rocket groups. Nobody has mentioned it. Winkler really, you know, only started working with this right around 27, 28
mm-hmm.
as well.
Yeah, I think we started at about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And we had heard about Winkler. We didn't meet him at that time.
Mm-hmm. Were you a member of the Verein für Raumschifffahrt?
We had our own GEFRA, Gesellschaft für Raketenforschung.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a Hanover group.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't feel it was necessary to join the VFR and get D-Rocket.
Well, it
the
also
journal.
Was too far away, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Normally I wouldn't go to Berlin, so normally wouldn't really mm-hmm. have any contact with the people. We knew that they had a club mm-hmm. similar to our club.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, that was later. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about D-Rocketa, the
yeah,
journal.
I hadn't
you didn't
even thought
see,
of it
even
that,
see that
our
journal,
activities
huh?
may have been the very early ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I know the Raketenflugplatz really only starts in late 1930. And of course, Winkler was experimenting. Well, I don't know if mm-hmm. he even fired up a rocket engine before 1929 or so.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think,
mm-hmm.
even on the ground test.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he started working only after he became involved with the VFR mm-hmm. and the Raketa and
yeah.
so forth. So that would make you very, very early.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, as I told you earlier, I'm a little bit poor with remembering specific dates.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned Pullenberg earlier. He's still living in Germany. Maybe mm-hmm. you, once you're over there again, you might want to talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
If he's still alive, he's in pretty poor health.
Mm-hmm.
And also his memory is not quite as good anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But he might even still have some documents. We published documents. We gave talks at that time. That was one way of raising money, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
To give a talk, to invite people to the launchings,
mm-hmm.
to pass a hat around,
right.
to get a few extra dollars, and that was really all the money we had.
Mm-hmm.
And our own spending money, which mm-hmm. was also very short, of course.
Mm-hmm. You went to a gymnasium, or what kind of...
No, I was in the Oberrealschule,
mm-hmm.
which taught only English and French, no Latin and no Greek.
Mm-hmm. And more science.
And more science, physics, mm-hmm. and things like that.
So you started with the University of Hanover when, in 1930,
in,
31?
31. And that's when I really stopped my rocket activities, yeah? So I'm pretty sure it must have been before that time, because I didn't mm-hmm. do any major work at that time. Pullenberg ever once in a while tried to involve me, but being a student, you are mm-hmm. so busy with new things that I really didn't have the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I also served at that time 1 year in the army.
Mm-hmm.
So that must have been from 32 to 33, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was still before Hitler took over. So it must have been 32.
Mm-hmm.
My dad wanted me to become a teacher, and mm-hmm. I was not interested in teaching at all, so I was really not too hot about it,
mm-hmm.
and that's why I left the university, to have a year to think about it, and after I came back in 1933, then I really went into the technical fields.
Were you in the in the Technische Hochschule, the first in the first year as well.
Both times, but the same university.
Mm-hmm. So you were in the Technische Hochschule Hannover.
Right.
Mm-hmm. From 31 to 32. Then you were out 1 year.
Right.
32, 33. Mm-hmm. And then you started again.
And then I started again, and then I went into strictly technical fields. My dad had consented in the meantime, well, if you really don't like teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And also teaching jobs were not that plentiful anymore. When I initially went to school, we had still a lot of unemployment, 31
right.
was very bad
the,
over
the
there.
Peak of the,
and,
the peak of the
chaos. There was practically no job you really could get. That was really the main reason for me to go to the university. I couldn't find a job.
Mm-hmm.
And then my dad felt, if you are a teacher, you once you are hired, you have a lifetime position. So that's why he wanted me to go into that field.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, I wasn't too hot about it. And I would have been a high school teacher, I would have had to know how to play the violin, you had to take music.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the subjects you had to dig into, and I really didn't like that at all.
Mm-hmm. So what was your, what kind of engineering did you
Well, of course,
major
the first
in?
Few years were basic engineering,
Mm-hmm.
And only the last few years I then concentrated on combustion engineering for diesel engines.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, even after I had graduated for about a year, maybe 2 years, an assistant to a Professor Neumann in Hanover. And he was running the Verbrennungskraftmaschinen Institute. And I was an assistant to him. And that was already just before the war. That was in 38.
Okay, so when did you, just to pin this down, you went back in 33, and when did you finish again?
In 38? Either 36 or 37.
Mm-hmm.
Probably 36, and then I stayed for a good year, year and a half, in the institute as an assistant to Neumann. And our specific task there with a group of students with whom I worked was to convert one of our old automobiles. We had a 1905 Daimler, not Daimler-Benz, just Daimler.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Daimler still did his own work at that time.
Right.
And we converted that to Flüssiggas, to propane gas.
Okay, liquid gas.
Yeah, we had a gas, a relatively small oil well close to Hanover in Nienburg.
Mm-hmm.
And besides the oil, they also recovered some natural gas.
Mm-hmm. The name of the place was Nienburg?
Nienburg.
N-I-E-N-B-U-R-G.
Right.
Okay, I think I've heard of
it. And there was a factory which made, on the one side, gasoline from the oil.
Mm-hmm.
And also from the byproducts, they got some propane and filled it in propane bottles. And it became clear already that we wouldn't have enough gasoline during the war, so there was quite a drive on from the Hitler regime at that time to go into these fields.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did, and well, I worked on it until the project was finished, and then I left and went to the VDO, as I mentioned earlier, VDO. The
okay.
Cometa outfit.
And that was in Hanover?
That was in early 39.
Mm-hmm.
I left Hanover in early 39 and went for about half a year to the VDO. So I was not there very long. And
the
then
VDO
when the war started...
Where was the VDO located?
That was in Frankfurt. Frankfurt Main.
Okay.
And when the war started, I was pretty soon drafted into the army because I was serving in military reserve duty. And, of course, all these people were immediately called. And that must have been late August, 39. And from then on, I was for about a year in the army. And then early next summer, I finally got my transfer to Peenemünde.
Mm-hmm. So did you serve in a campaign in that 39-40? Did you serve
in Poland or France? We walked on foot through all of France.
Mm-hmm.
We started way down south, the south of Strasbourg, even at the Swiss border, really.
Mm-hmm.
And then we walked behind the Maginot Line, almost all the way to Dunkirk.
Mm-hmm.
But Dunkirk had fallen, or the Allied forces had gone back over the channel, So we never made it all the way to Dunkirk.
Mm-hmm.
But we stopped in there and turned around and walked all the way back again to Strasbourg. And in Strasbourg, we then finally went back over the Rhine, and we were stationed in Freiburg, in Baden.
So you would have been transferred just after the successful conclusion of the French campaign.
Right after that.
French and Low Countries.
And my
campaign.
Company later on was transferred to Russia, but I never went with them to Russia. Mm-hmm. So before that happened, I got out of the army. Mm-hmm. I worked for a little while, for just a few months, for the VDO again. And then I got Dienstverpflichtet. You probably have heard the term Dienstverpflichtet already. So Peenemünde really called me, yeah? And mm-hmm. that's why I said it was easy. Peenemünde had a fairly good priority at that time. So they could call on people they knew were interested in that field. Mm-hmm. And so I was really called Dienstverpflichtet to Peenemünde.
Mm-hmm. Now, because that raises a question, I guess I get this straight. As far as Pillenberg was concerned, he wrote you then before
well,
the
we
war?
Had, we had continuing correspondence. Mm-hmm. I know him quite well. His dad worked also for the postal office. So our dads were fairly closely acquainted. Mm-hmm. And due to that connection, I had also correspondence with him, not very frequently, maybe for Christmas and Easter mm-hmm. or so. But we stayed in contact, and that's the way I found out about the activities in Peenemünde.
When did you sort of figure out what was going on up there, that there was something going on about
Well, of
rockets.
Course, after I had heard about it, I seem to recall I made first a visit and had to introduce myself. Mm-hmm. I met Walter Thiel at that time, really the number two man after von Braun, mm-hmm. before the bomb raid. He was killed in the bomb raid. And he apparently was interested, and he then Dienstverpflichtet me. He then mm-hmm. called me to Peenemünde.
So you would have visited the first time and then gone away again at one time?
I think I went back home again, and then I finally got my final assignment. Mm-hmm. And of course, at that time, when I was up there, then I learned basically what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. In the past, all you had known was that Pillenberg was doing something probably regarding rockets.
Right.
But you didn't know what. And did you even know approximately where he was, or was that
no,
secret
no.
too?
I had lost the contact with him until he wrote to me again and mm-hmm. announced that this kind of work was going on there. Mm-hmm. Interesting work for me was going mm-hmm. on there.
That would have been about 1940 already then, huh?
That probably was early in 1940.
Mm-hmm. So you got called then through that connection and through your going up there and meeting them, you got called to Peenemünde.
Right.
And mm-hmm. in late 1940, something like that?
No, that was early summer 1940. So mm-hmm. I would say June, July. Mm-hmm. So relatively early in summer.
Okay, so that would have been almost at the very end of the campaign then, right?
The French campaign, was it not even in 38?
No, the French campaign was just over in June 1940.
June 1940. Then it was just at the end of the French campaign.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you probably went just after you got back from that campaign.
Right.
You got
mm-hmm.
called into... You were probably assigned to the Versuchskommando Nord, right?
I guess this army unit.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you remember mm-hmm. that name of that?
Well, Versuchskommando Nord was really a military unit.
Yeah.
It was not in existence at the time when I got up there.
It was.
Military people were only assigned to Peenemünde in 42 or so. So mm-hmm. in 40, it was strictly, there were some army people.
Yeah.
Dornberger was there and a few mm-hmm. other captains with him. But the main workforce were really civilians, like I, Dienstverpflichtet.
Uh-huh. So you were not then assigned as an army
no,
person.
No, I had left the army.
So you effectively been released from
civilian.
The army,
I was
put
a
back
civilian.
On reserve.
Right.
You're put back on army reserve, mm-hmm. and you were Dienstverpflichtet. Mm-hmm. You're sent to Peenemünde then in the summer of 40. Okay, mm-hmm. I just want to get this straight. Mm-hmm. See, I'm not even sure about Versuchskommando Nord, when it started, when it existed.
Yeah, that must have been 2 years or so later.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, Hitler had declared the A4, as we mm-hmm. called it in those days, mm-hmm. of a high priority, and then we could draw an army personnel. And there was even an order out to the army to assign all technically qualified people to Peenemünde.
Mm-hmm.
But that happened only later. That was at the time after the A4 had been declared again of high priority. You probably have heard already. At some time it was on, then it was off again, then it was on again.
Mm-hmm.
So that kept on changing. And in the beginning, it was strictly an army project. Really, the party had nothing to do with it. It was strictly run by the army. And that's why, of course, initially we got army people. Later on, we got also a lot of Air Force people, after the Air Force got also involved with the Wasserfall particularly. But in the early years, it was strictly an army activity. And as I said, at the time when I got there, it was strictly a civilian activity. And
you didn't see the army officer. I mean, of course, there was an old group of people from Heereswaffenamt who had come through Dornberger, Sonsen.
And some of them, a few of them were there, but a relatively small group, and they did mostly managerial work. They administered the whole organization. They were not technical people. I would even say Dornberger was probably the only technical man. You probably know he had a... an engineering degree.
I think Sonsen was an engineer as well.
Sonsen could have been one too. Yeah. But all the others were regular army officers, and so they didn't really participate in the development as such. They were, administered.
They were basically in the base commander office and at that level. So you were then taken into Thiel's group. He must have just actually have come from Kummersdorf, not very long
before
that.
Yeah, he was still fairly new, I seem to recall. And probably that's why he was interested to hire additional people. Yeah, that's why he was interested for me to come up after I talked to him and I told him I had a certain background in combustion engineering and he was looking for people like that. And for that reason, of course, he put me, after I was up there right away on the job, to develop the injection units of the A4 engine. You probably have seen it, the way we have it out there. We have 18 individual elements, Töpfer as we call it, that initially mix the propellants and then, of course, the 18 elements mix again in the main chamber. And my first job was to work on these individual elements. And for that purpose, we even had a smaller engine, a 1.4-ton engine. Each and every one of these elements has 1.4-ton Schub. And we did all the basic, the initial research on the smaller unit, the 1.4-ton unit. And I also worked on a 1-ton unit, which was strapped to airplanes. A JATO, jet-assisted takeoff.
And Starthilfe.
Yeah, and that was a very similar unit. It had also a somewhat conical head, then a combustion chamber about that long.
Was then, about a foot long?
Yeah. And then a nozzle, a rocket throat area, which gave us a lot of problems. So I spent also quite some time on solving all these burn-through problems. And they normally burn through in the throat area, where you have, of course, a very high velocity and still fairly high temperatures.
Let me tackle one of these things at a time. When you came to Starthilfe, and of course this is one of the things I have to figure out, that Starthilfe project, the JATO project, that was still going, was it?
Right.
That was just at the end of development, or you still had a lot of problems?
We built already the ready units, and they were being used, they were being flown. For some reason or other, I never really quite understood why. Maybe the reason was these units were developed by the Army, and they were then turned over to the Air Force, and the Air Force apparently was not too impressed with them. So they really, I think, to my knowledge, they never got really into major operational use. Some of them were used. There were certainly some demonstration flights, some of which I saw.
At Peenemünde West.
At Peenemünde West.
At the Air Force And that was the test. So the tests at Peenemünde West were certainly later than after you got there.
Right. They were later after the unit had been more or less developed.
So that would have been later in 1940, probably?
Later 40 and possibly even 41. Possibly even into 42.
I know that the fact they decided to go over to a hydrogen peroxide one that was developed by Valter.
That
so they
could
had
be one of the reasons. I hadn't even thought of that. You may have a point there. They are simpler. They are not quite as efficient, but you drop them anyway. Yeah. So if they are a little bit heavier, it's not all that critical.
Yours was based on liquid oxygen.
Liquid oxygen and gasoline.
And gasoline, not alcohol.
To my knowledge, not alcohol.
So it was liquid oxygen and gasoline. Of course, that meant handling a cryogenic fluid in the start.
And that's, of course, pretty tough, as you realize.
So it had its disadvantages, but yeah, as you say, it may also have been Army versus Luftwaffe.
Mm-hmm.
But when you came, that one-ton engine was still having problems.
Both of them had still major problems. The one-ton for the Starthilfe, and also the 1.4-ton unit. And one of the major problems was really the efficiency, the combustion quality was just not there. And my main job was to find out how to improve the injection system. I don't know how well you know the design. There were fuel nozzles all around, I think four rows of fuel nozzles, and some of them injected directly, some others atomized the fuel and generated fuel mist. And we shuffled these around quite a bit. And we finally came to a design where lots of these holes could be just drilled into the ball. So they were just straight holes, and we had only a few nozzles which atomized the fuel to improve the, or to quicken up the combustion. And that worked fairly pretty well. And also when we finally put all these elements together, due to the additional mixing, apparently the combustion quality was pretty good when you used the whole, the larger system. Yeah, there you have the picture.
This is from Gerhard Reissig's article series. And of course, you know, he has a fairly detailed discussion of those propulsion issues on there. But so there were still more refinements needed on that basic injector head, the top that
and also the LOX injection. You probably know the LOX nozzles in the center of the unit, and there's only one LOX unit to keep it simple. And that also had only straight holes in it. And the straight holes sprayed, and they were supposed to spray over the entire unit so that you had a LOX droplet right next to each and every fuel droplet.
So I remember that from that pictures that there was, it was like a little dome in the center.
Right.
That dome was where the LOX came, was injected.
Right.
And so that you just drilled straight holes there. You didn't try to drill special nozzle holes.
But the holes were under specific angles, therefore it's not a straight spherical surface. It had some steps in it, so that the holes could be easily drilled under a 90-degree angle.
Okay, so as far
and
as...
that was one of my first tests, to develop the LOX injection system and the fuel system.
How did you proceed in the test process doing that? Did you just
purely experimental.
You just tried something different each time that you did
it. Yeah, now we worked with the University of Dresden. And they were specialists in fuel injection. And they consulted with us, and they made recommendations for new designs and things like that. So it was not only my doing and my experimenting, but we had some scientific help, really.
That was that the Institute of Professor Wewerka, or was there somebody
no,
else?
No, Wewerka was turbopumps. And I don't right offhand even recall who was a head there. I don't think it was Wewerka.
Yeah, I have some documents regarding Dresden, but I don't have them with me, so I don't remember who is who. I know that there was a whole group of people there. It was one of your...
We had Küttner there, who was quite active and spent a lot of time in Peenemünde, but he was basically still stationed in Dresden. We had Lindenberg there. I saw Lindenberg's name. He was the very first one to die in this country, in Fort Bliss still. And he was permanently stationed in Peenemünde. So he did practically all his work there, and again, he helped in all these design activities.
Officially, though, he remained, at least for a while, an employee of the Technische Hochschule Dresden.
I think he did. I think he did, yeah.
Officially worked in the Institute at Dresden, even though he was there. The other guy was Küttner.
Küttner, yeah.
Were they involved from the beginning when you were there?
Yeah, they certainly were relatively soon involved. Now, I don't know if they were there ahead of me. Again, Thiel had all these contacts, and he invited these people. He wrote the contract with these people. And it must have been around the time when I got there.
Yeah, because I've seen the documents that indicate right in September 1939 they brought Dresden in. And in fact, another folder, I don't think this one, I have the document that indicates the discussion at Kummersdorf between Thiel and a number of people from Dresden.
Yeah, Thiel was really the one who had these connections. I'm sure he wrote the contract, or he provided the basic gist for the contract, and they probably had contracting people to actually write the contract. And you probably know we worked, of course, quite extensively with universities. Universities and also private industry.
And I think the university angle, there needs to be a lot more done with that than has been. I think that's a whole area of research that nobody has. Everybody, you know, every book states, well, there was some university work, but it's one of the things I want to cover.
And they wrote a lot of contracts. There may even have been some contracts in your stack there that were written by Dresden. Reports on injection, what kind of designs to use, what kind of designs were successful. And I also started at that time, well, that was even while I was still in the university, I started to use a lot of NACA reports. You know, before NASA we had an NACA. And I read quite a number of the reports written by a Mr. Something with Roth, Rothstein, Rothenberg, or something like that. And he did these reports for either Langley or...
Ames?
Or Ames. No, I don't think it was Ames.
Lewis was...
Lewis. I think he was working with or for Lewis.
This would have been on combustion in...
That was still jet engines, yeah? Jet engine injection. And he studied also what do you have to do in order to really have good, efficient combustion.
You sure it wasn't piston engine combustion?
Could have been piston engine combustion.
Yeah,
he really
did
only injection studies, yeah? And then he put a piece of paper under it and he measured where do you get most of your fuel. And then he tried to improve it to have an even distribution over the whole piece of paper. So he made some very basic studies. And I read quite a number of his reports, and of course I drew my conclusions from these reports and tried to implement some of his ideas.
So that there really was an influence from earlier
we had
aircraft engine injection.
Some pretty fair information. I think I mentioned I knew Goddard's book. I had that. And we apparently also, maybe again through universities, we also could get these reports. Well, as I said, I was still in Hanover when I got a hold of these reports. And, of course, universities have normally pretty good libraries that contain all these reports. And I finally even met that guy in one of the earlier meetings here.
Really?
Yeah, and he was also pleased in a way that his work was not only being used here, but even over there.
Okay. Thiel, I haven't asked you yet to describe him or you know, what was he like as a person?
Well, he was also a very dynamic man. He was a little bit like von Braun. He was not quite as much interested in general publicity. He was more strictly engineering-oriented. And I think he was an excellent engineer. I think really most of the credit for the V2 engine should go to him. And the engine was more or less in existence when I came up there. It didn't work. We had to make it to work. But the basic design was there. The combustion chamber was there. I think he was the one who came up with the idea of a turbopump. And he worked with Weverka. And that was basically in the turbopump area. He was the one who built the steam plant in order to drive the turbine. And we worked with Walter in that area. We got our hydrogen peroxide from Walter. And so Thiel should really get an awful lot of credit for that. And of course, since he died during the bomb raid on Peenemünde, he's normally not being mentioned too much.
Yeah. This actually, I guess Rice agrees with you, because this article also emphasizes Thiel's role. Maybe I should leave the diagram out.
Yeah, and I think that was really the biggest loss for Peenemünde when he died, when he was not there anymore. And he was working already on a Mischdüse, an improved version of the rocket chamber, which is pretty close to the Redstone engine. We were working already on these designs, and I think the Redstone engine was finally built this way by North American Rockwell, because Riedel again from the University of Berlin, who worked with us in Peenemünde. He was finally hired by North American Rockwell. Mm-hmm. And so he knew about all these ideas and he then implemented them.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to do it in Peenemünde, but we had considerable combustion instability problems. So the combustion, you probably heard about combustion instability.
Right.
And we never got over that, so we finally decided to use this engine.
Mm-hmm.
If Thiel would have been there, I personally would guess that he might have succeeded in mm-hmm. switching to the much simpler Mischdüse
mm-hmm.
Injection system.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of details that I want to get out of that, all that you've just
mm-hmm.
said. So you came in and you worked on the Starthilfe motor, and probably by 1941 sometime, you had solved the problems with getting that to work
mm-hmm.
without having burn-throughs, right, and combustion
right.
instabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And you were also at the beginning working on this 1.4-ton thrust.
Right, and actually these works went on parallel.
Mm-hmm.
We had two different test stands. The 1-tonner was tested on one test stand, the 1.4 unit on another test stand,
mm-hmm.
and so we could do the work parallel.
Was the 1.4-ton the same motor that you used in A3 and A5?
It's actually this unit here, this head
mm-hmm.
unit. And it was strictly a test motor, so it was only used for testing. It had no
mm-hmm.
project application.
Okay, so the A5 motor was something that stemmed from an earlier...
That was an earlier design. Yeah.
Right, that was... Okay, mm-hmm. that's right. That was this design here. That,
right.
That
right.
had that
yeah, yeah.
very long
and that
combustion
was quite
chamber.
Different, a very long combustion chamber. Again, probably people didn't atomize their propellants well enough. So
mm-hmm.
you needed some time for them to react, yeah? If you
mm-hmm.
have a good reaction, you can do it with a very short chamber.
Mm-hmm. So, according to this description from Gerhard Reisig, in that motor you had the problem of the very great length meant that you ended up getting combustion instability in there. You'd have good burning in one part, good mixing and burning
mm-hmm.
in one part of it, and you'd get waves, standing
mm-hmm.
waves set up.
Yeah,
so that you'd have hot
and
spots,
I never had
anything
to do with that motor. That was, as far
mm-hmm.
as I know, designed and built already in Kummersdorf.
Mm-hmm.
It was tested finally in Peenemünde in the A5s, of course. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got into the act, we only worked on the A4.
Mm-hmm. So that the first thing that you saw was, let's get almost the end of the tape. But this side, the first thing that you were working on when was the 1.4. I also know that you had experimented with the intermediate size 4.2,
right,
which 4.2, is three injectors,
three
together.
Systems in order to get some pre-mixing.
Mm-hmm.
And the 4.2 ton unit had therefore already a better exhaust velocity. We
mm-hmm.
used exhaust velocity in this country. We use ISP,
mm-hmm.
which is basically the same. Different
mm-hmm.
dimension, but...
Right. Mm-hmm. When you came in, do you remember whether in the middle of 40, whether there'd already been work on the 4.2-ton
yeah,
motor with
I
three...
I worked on that also pretty soon mm-hmm. after we had solved the problems on the 1.4-tonner. Whenever we had a good design, which we thought was a good design, then we introduced it automatically in the 4.2-ton unit.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we had a separate test stand for that, so
mm-hmm.
we could do all this work parallel.
Mm-hmm. As far as you remember, the 4.2 existed already?
I did not do the design of the chamber.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it must have existed. And even this chamber here existed already when I came to Peenemünde.
Mm-hmm. So you'd already seen, it wasn't just a drawing board concept, the 18
It had been
injector.
Built already.
Mm-hmm.
It had been built.
Mm-hmm.
As I said earlier, it didn't always work. Yeah, in fact, in most of the cases, it didn't work. It blew up.
Mm-hmm. Was it only? Do you know whether it was only tested at Peenemünde or at Kummersdorf?
I don't think this was tested in Kummersdorf. It's a pretty large engine, and you
mm-hmm.
need a relatively big test stand for it.
Mm-hmm.
And we had these big test stands only in Peenemünde. That's why they went to Peenemünde to be able to build these big facilities and also
mm-hmm.
to launch from there. So I don't think that was ever tested in Kummersdorf.
All right, I think you're right, because I don't think there was the... Mm-hmm. They didn't have the test stand of sufficient size to test the 25-ton,
right.
25-ton mm-hmm. motor. I'm just seeing if I have a tape here. So the when you first worked with the 25-ton motor, when was that? Was that months after you got there, or...?
Well, it was a little bit... After I got there, I would say late 41, 42.
Mm-hmm.
It may have been a little earlier. Let's say 41.
Mm-hmm. That's when yeah. you feel that the 25-ton mm-hmm. motor was mm-hmm. really put together
yeah.
and first mm-hmm. actually tested. The as far as you know, the drawing board concept of putting 18 injectors together...
That was in already, existence.
That yeah. had already right. in existence.
And there was nothing much I could do. I could only work on the details, on the injection detail, the mixing detail. And, of course, we still made a lot of changes. You may have seen also on the engine we have out at the rocket center, we had to introduce a lot of additional cooling,
mm-hmm.
FM cooling, we call it, because basically it was done for the throat area. We called the throat area FM.
Mm-hmm.
F for Fläche, minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to prevent burn-throughs here, we injected extra fuel just on top over the FM area.
Mm-hmm.
And later on we found out we also have to introduce additional fuel and all these other things.
Mm-hmm.
So that detail of the design was not there. That's what I had to develop in order to make it work. But the basic principle was in existence.
Okay.